Hello and welcome to the spoilers for The Tragedy of Mariam. Normally at this point I'd say stop listening if you don't want to be spoiled, but actually this episode is not interested in the future plot. This is about the setup, the story so far before we start on Act 1 next time. And this is a play with a lot of backstory. So you can stop listening now if you wish, but I think it's fair to say we're now entering not spoiler land, so you're mostly safe.
Not spoiler land!
Yes. Yes, I don't know why I keep doing that. So before we start working through the play, here's a general introduction to The Tragedy of Mariam by Elizabeth Carey. Or Miriam, for some reason. Some people spell it with an I, and I genuinely don't know why. There's only, as far as I can see, one original print run, and it's clearly spelt with an A, and all the editions I've ever seen has it spelt with an A. And I keep seeing on the internet, it's spelt with an I. Why is... No, serious question, people. What's going on there? I mean, even Google thinks it's weird. So, please, someone enlighten me. Sorry, let's get to talking about things that are helpful. So, Mariam, it's a play with so many print editions, with so many productions, or almost productions, that we almost don't actually need to do it as a company. It's almost too mainstream for us. Except in one respect, that at time of recording of this, and as far as I can see, there hasn't been a mainstream production by any of the really big companies, which is just baffling, genuinely baffling. Mariam is almost the perfect example of the problem of the rehearsed reading / fringe theatre route for developing underperformed plays. It's staged for a one-off performance or for a relatively short run, and then everyone seems to feel good about themselves, and then it doesn't go any further. And then someone else, somewhere else, does exactly the same thing again. And then maybe it pops up in another production, but still quite small, and then people go back to doing rehearsed readings, and it doesn't seem to help. And because this isn't an obscure play, when you can buy a dozen different editions, when you can find a performance history too long to even talk about in detail in an introduction, when this isn't even the first time I've done this play, then the question really is, why RSC? Why Globe? Why National? What is wrong with you? And relax. So Mariam gets a lot of textual interest, in part because it stands at the crossroads between a number of issues around gender and race and history, and I will be touching on those things, but I am mostly going to focus on the dramaturgy. How does the play function? What are the characters doing? If you want to go further, there is so much out there, and there are people much more qualified to talk about those issues, and I will be putting those details on the show notes, and there's a website that at this precise second in time, I don't have the website in front of me, but which has collated a lot of this information. There is a YouTube video of a student production from many years ago. I know that Lazarus Theatre Company did a production a few years ago, and we did talk to them briefly about that in an episode primarily about Marlowe. So there are other people out there who've talked about this play. For this, I can only relate my experience as a producer, and that is what I will now attempt to do. So, there are plays you can dip into immediately and feel totally at home. This is a play which feels, certainly for the first few minutes, and maybe even the first half an hour, it feels like you need to swat up on before you engage with it. Hence, actually, this first episode general introduction. I don't actually think you do, but it feels like there's a lot that matters that happened before the play starts. People are constantly referring to backstory. And this play isn't unusual in this regard. There is a fair number of history plays that sort of expect you to know the area of the action, and this is a sort of history play. The backstory isn't complex, really, but it is very detailed and it's all about court intrigue. So there's a lot of moving parts, and I've been getting muddled by the details for about 10 years. So really, don't feel bad if you get confused a little bit. Most of it is actually very simple. It's just people with slightly silly names who did stuff before the play opened. And there are a lot of slightly silly names. And we've made decisions about pronunciation. Some of them are better than others. Some of them are contradictory. I don't feel like you should gatekeep too heavily as to how some of these names are said, and that sometimes you should just quietly change them. It really is up to you, I feel. That's my personal opinion. Anyway, more on that later when we come to some of the more trickier names. The opening of Act One, which we'll look at next time, does try really hard to throw backstory at you in conversation and monologue, but it's still quite a lot to take in. And names fly past you, and in places, it's tough to follow. I don't think you need to follow that too heavily. But anyway, the play text has an argument. But the argument isn't a performance text. Now, this is a closet drama. This play isn't necessarily designed with the expectation of being performed publicly. There's some debate on that. But regardless of where we place the play as actually performed when it was written, it is designed to be performable, even if that performance is in your head, your living room, a public or private stage. The argument, however, isn't a performed prologue. It's a literary device for the reader to fill you in. The only real problem with the argument in this play is it actually is more bamboozling than it is clarifying. And at the end of this episode, we do stagger through the argument, and you can hear our general confusion. So, as I say, once again, hence that feeling of needing to swat up a bit to enjoy the opening of the play, which is a shame, because I don't think it matters. I really don't think it does. And it's even more of a shame because Act One is amazing. But that's next episode. So, backstory. Once upon a time, dinosaurs ruled the world. And one of those dinosaurs was called Herod. And he's a bit murdery. He's a king of Judea, but he rules at the pleasure of the Roman overlords. Now, he got married in the past to, genuine name here, Doris. Now, we're entering the sort of silly name territory here, except Doris isn't a silly name in the way that other names might, in a sort of Anglophile way, feel silly. It's just Doris feels very down to earth in a way that a queen doesn't feel. Queen Doris just doesn't feel right. And in the past, previous productions, we've sort of tried to strangeify the name Doris. With this production, so far, we've just landed directly on it, however day-to-day it is. Anyway, Herod marries Doris, has a child, Antipater, which is also the name of Herod's father. And Herod then sees Mariam, instantly falls in love with her, and divorces Doris because he can, because he's a man, and he marries Mariam of the title, in part because she has a better lineage than him. And there is a very important question of dynastic succession about who has a better claim to the throne as a Jewish leader, because Herod's lineage is not as pure as Mariam's is. And so there is a political aspect to that, of his children via Mariam will have a better claim to the throne than children via Doris. So Doris is divorced, their child is disinherited, and she goes off into exile from the court. So Herod has married Mariam partly for politics, and in part because he fancied her rotten. He is utterly in love with her, though the definition of what his love, inverted commas there, his definition of what is love really is open to discussion later. I think it's better to say Herod is in controlly obsessy with his wife rather than love, but we'll come back to that. So, to recap, Doris and her son, with Herod, are out. Mariam is in. And Mariam is having children too, so there is a new dynasty in place. So, you'd think it's quids in for Mariam's extended family. Yes, obviously there's a certain elevation for her family, and no, because her family have in many ways a better claim to the throne than Herod himself, he kind of kills off any of them who are men and a bit of a threat, real or otherwise. Interesting questions of paranoia for Herod will arise. So Herod kills Mariam's grandfather, Hyrcanus, and her brother Aristobulus, although we've gone for Aristobulus. Again, pronunciations of names, changing vowels occasionally. The Aristobulus didn't quite sound right, and I didn't like it, so I changed it. The weird detail with Mariam's brother is that Herod promoted him first to be high priest for all of about 5 minutes, and then had him killed. So a bit of a rise, then a fall. That means the only survivors of Mariam's family, apart from her children, are women. Mariam and her mother, Alexandra, who is, shall we say, not a fan of Herod. She's going to dob Herod right in it, and therefore make him not desperately fond of her. I'm not quite sure why she's still alive. But anyway, so Mariam's placed in a very difficult situation. The person she is married to is sort of murdering her family. And so there's pluses and minuses here that have to be negotiated. That's something that will come up later. Now, we've mentioned the ex-wife Doris. She's hanging around in the distance, waiting for a chance to get her son by Herod on the throne. But then there's other people in this power struggle. There's Herod's two siblings, Pheroras, his brother, who in theory has been matched up with a child bride for politics, but who wants to marry a servant, Gryphina, who we will meet briefly. So he wants to marry for love, but he can't because his brother Herod is insisting on this match with the child bride. So that side of the family dynamic's a bit tense. Then there's Salome, Herod's sister. And I think it's important to say that it's not really the same Salome that you'll find in Oscar Wilde, who is the stepdaughter of a later Herod. There's lots of Herods. There are lots of Salomes in history. This is another Salome, who is explicitly Herod's sister, and who actually, in history, comes out quite well. That's another question for later. Whether thematically there's a link in the author's mind, that's a question for discussion later. I don't want to start from that point. I don't want to start from a sort of murdery starting point for Salome, because I think she's a much more interesting character than that. She is a player politically in the household. So, Salome wants autonomy. She wants autonomy from her brother and from her husbands. Now, you could say that Salome is an irrepressible romantic. She falls in love so easily many, many times. She doesn't settle in any relationship long before falling for someone else. But because, as a woman, she can't divorce, her husband can divorce her, she cannot divorce him, she has to find other ways to remarry. So, Salome's first husband, Josephus, who gets the odd name check in the play, was sort of dobbed in it by Salome, in part so that she could remarry into, as far as the play is concerned, her current husband, Constobarus. Now, the backstory for the getting rid of Josephus is a little fiddly. So Herod, it's a little confusing because it's very similar to the events leading up to the play. So Herod is called out, effectively, by Mariam's mother, Alexandra. She appeals to Mark Antony. So there's a power struggle going on in Rome as well. So that's quite an important element going on there. Alexandra calls out Herod and asks Mark Antony to intercede and get rid of him. And Herod goes off to Rome, and he says to Josephus, Salome's husband, you're in charge. If I'm going to die, could you make sure that Mariam is suitably killed as a sort of parting gesture? Because, you know, she shouldn't live on without me. And Josephus sort of tells Mariam this. And the moment Herod returns, having placated Mark Antony, who's a good mate with him, they're good mates, Mark Antony and Herod, Salome immediately dobs Josephus in it and gets him killed, basically. It's probably a bit more complicated than that, and I don't think you really need to know all of that detail. Salome gets rid of husband number one and marries Constabarus. Unfortunately, around the time this play now starts, she's fallen in love with Silius, an Arabian prince, and Constabarus doesn't want to divorce her so that she can marry who she loves. Salome is in the position she doesn't have the power to do what she wants, and so she's having to do other things to make that happen. And that's a very important theme that will come through the play. Let's talk about Salome's current husband. Let's talk about Constabarus, who's also doing politicky things as well, because he is all about tradition and honour and not allowing his wife to have any autonomy. He's also political. He's kept hidden a couple of sons of some bloke called Babus. Now, these two sons were ordered dead by Herod, and Constabarus, doing the sort of woodsman role here, decided to keep them hidden for about 12 years. And the thing is, Salome knows about this. Otherwise, the court of Herod has various supernumeraries wandering around. There's a new high priest, who was actually the predecessor to the brother of Mariam, who became high priest. He has a walk on Blink and You'll Miss It cameo. And then there's the higher up functionary, Sohemus, who's the follower on from Josephus. And he's also caught in the politics of it all, and may or may not come out the other side. Who will survive this play? It's not the bloodiest of plays, but there's a fair number of victims. It is called The Tragedy of Mariam for a reason. I don't think that's a spoiler. Servants there are aplenty, nuntios and butlers who appear as plot devices, exposition and walking lampshades. If your head is spinning, relax. Once you're in the fray of the action, the precise details can be there and useful, but you hopefully can just let the drama of the moment take you. Yes, you might like to know the full details as to why Mariam's mum hates Herod, but you can get by with the fact that she does. That some killings happened. Does it really matter which precise member of the family it was or the background of it? Doesn't really matter. She just hates him because of murdery death. Because now we're hitting the crisis that starts the action of the play. Herod has once again been called back to Rome. Because Herod was good mates with Mark Antony, as we've mentioned, who previously called him back to Rome. And Mark Antony is a big name check throughout, as is at one point Cleopatra. Herod, this time, is recalled by Caesar Augustus, because Mark Antony has now fallen. So another dynastic struggle happening somewhere else. Augustus calls Mark Antony's mate Herod in, and everyone's assuming that that means Herod is very, very dead. So this leaves a power vacuum. Everyone's jostling for power, as well as jostling their emotions, their loves and hates. So Doris, Herod's ex-wife, comes back, hoping to get her son in a position of power. Pheroras, Herod's brother, hopes to marry his chosen bride rather than the political match. Salome, Herod's sister, hopes to divorce her husband, Constabarus. Constabarus, Salome's husband, hopes to free the hidden sons of Babus because now the threat to their life is gone. And Mariam, Herod's wife, doesn't have a Scooby what to hope for. What to feel about any of it. And that's the crisis that opens the play. The absence of Herod throws all the plates up in the air. It throws a whole host of questions for the characters to try and answer. And the question for the audience is, in the chaos, who is going to come out on top and who will be crushed under the wheel of fortune? And I don't think it's a spoiler once again to reiterate, the play is called The Tragedy of Mariam. But find out next time on Spoilers as I dive into the wonders and occasional diversions of Act One. But till then, here's what almost was this first episode of Spoilers. I mentioned earlier in the text there is an argument, a recap of the action prior to and into the play, and I thought I'd just record that, put a bit of a gloss to it, and then we tried to record it and found that it was written in a way that led us to be more confused. Basically, if you want to use a friendly introduction to the action, the argument is not it. Run for the hills. It's really fiddly. All the information's there. It's just laid out in a way that just... So, there are more spoilers coming up now, because we are going to go into the action of the play itself, so stop now if you don't want to be really spoiled or confused. This was recorded almost at the end of a very long recording session with the actor Pamela Flanagan and I, and we just couldn't face doing a proper take of this. We did a read-through of it, and so this is what you're getting. This is more an exploration rather than a proper recording. So, till next time, and Act One, I've been your host, Robert Crichton, and now you can hear Pamela Flanagan and I stagger through for you the not desperately performance-friendly printed argument. Many thanks to Pamela for being a sport, and coming back to this play after several months away, when we'd forgotten pretty much everything about it.
So, tell us all about it, please.
So, the argument. Herod, the son of Antipater, an Idumean?
Idumean.
He's an Idumean. Okay.
It's another one of these. How do you pronounce the bloody thing? Antipater.
There's
a character in the play who's called Antipater as well, who's his son by the first wife.
Of course.
Doris.
Okay.
That's helpful. Yes. Let's start that one again.
Okay. The argument. Herod, the son of Antipater, an Idumean. Okay. Herod, the son of Antipater, an Idumean. Sorry.
I'm assuming that's just how I've been saying it. I don't know. I think, to be fair, you've recorded it. You actually say it in the play at some point.
That's worrying. It could say anything. So, fourth time's the charm. The argument. Herod, the son of Antipater, an Idumean, I'm going with that, having crept by the favour of the Romans into the Jewish monarchy, married Mariam. The granddaughter of Hyrcanus?
Yes, Hyrcanus we went for.
Hyrcanus.
Have you got granddaughter?
Yes.
Yeah, good. Someone's corrected the minor error. That's good. I don't have it corrected here.
Okay.
So Mariam is the daughter of Hyrcanus, people.
The granddaughter.
Granddaughter.
Okay. The granddaughter of Hyrcanus.
Yeah, I keep getting this wrong, so this is great.
The rightful king and priest. And for her, besides her being high blood, being of singular beauty, he repudiated Doris, his former wife, by whom he had children.
He divorced Doris, his first wife. So this is
I forgot about Doris, sorry. I was thinking Doris was the mother, but no.
No.
Okay, I'm going back because I have forgotten all of this. So he married Mariam, the granddaughter of Hyrcanus, the rightful king and priest, and for her, besides her high blood being of singular beauty, he repudiated Doris, his former wife, by whom he had children. This Mariam had a brother called Aristobulus,
Very well remembered. I think you had to... I don't know if you had to say Aristobulus.
I can't remember.
Aristobulus, I think, is possibly more accurate, but I just couldn't... I just has too many...
Aristobulus. But Ebola, isn't it?
It's very weird. It's very weird. Go Aristobulus is good.
Okay. This Mariam had a brother called Aristobulus, and next him and Hyrcanus, his grandfather, Herod in his wife's right had the best title. Therefore, to remove them, he charged the second with treason and put him to death, and drowned the first under colour of sport. Alexandra.
Is it that way round?
That's what it says here, yeah.
That's really interesting. In my edition, it's the other way around. He charged the first for treason and he drowned the second under the colour of sport. Oh. I love these variant editions.
It's great.
It's great. It's great. I'm going to get a third one out. I've got another one over here.
See what it says. And who has written...
No wonder I keep getting lost as to who's happening and what's going on.
Who has written these arguments?
It's from the additional, and it's from the edition. Or I think there are a couple of editions.
So
ones are revised. And
did the Lady Falkland?
Yeah, so charged first with treason. I've got first here with treason, and the drowned second under cover of sport. So that edition...
Says second,
The edition you got given because it's got the largest print. Because I never bothered printing the argument out as part of the script.
I'm getting old and I can't read. Actually, I feel a bit like that. Alexandra, daughter to the one and mother to the other. What? Alexandra, daughter of one of the brothers and mother to the other? What?
So this is where, it's all a bit untidy, isn't it? So, okay, so. Mariam has a brother called Aristobulus.
Yes.
Right? And Alexandra must be the mother to one of them.
But then it says daughter to...
Daughter to Hyrcanus, Mariam's grandfather.
Okay.
It's a complicated family tree.
Yes, and also written in a very complicated way.
Yes.
Okay. So Alexandra, daughter to the one and mother to the other, accused him for their deaths before Antony. So when he was forced to go answer this accusation at Rome, he left the custody of his wife to Josephus, his uncle, that had married his sister Salome. And out of a violent affection... unwilling that any should enjoy her after him, he gave strict and private commandment that if he were slain, she should be put to death. But he returned with much honour, yet found his wife extremely discontented, to whom Josephus had, meaning it for the best to prove Herod loved her, revealed his charge. So, by Salome's accusation, he put Josephus to death, but was reconciled to Mariam, who still bare the death of her friends exceedingly hardly.
Have you got hardly?
I do.
That's very strange. I've just got exceedingly hard here.
Yes, that would seem to make more sense.
That would make a lot more sense.
Yeah. And I presume bare means bore? Still bore the death of her friends?
Still bore, I've got here.
And it's her relatives, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay.
So, your first husband, Salome.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Josephus.
Yes.
Was the person looking after
Mariam
while Herod went away on a totally separate journey.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing to do with the play coming up, even though he goes on a journey in that as well.
Mm-hmm.
So just to be absolutely clear, you then persuade your brother to have Josephus killed.
Mm-hmm.
By your accusations, you get him killed, and that's great. That's great.
It's good for me.
Good for you. Good for you. In the meantime.
Okay. In this meantime. In this meantime, Herod was again necessarily to revisit Rome, for Caesar, having thrown Antony, his great friend, was likely to make an alteration of his fortune. In his absence, news came to Jerusalem that Caesar had put him to death. Their willingness, it should be so, together with the likelihood, gave this rumour so good credit, as Sohemus, that had succeeded Josephus' charge, succeeded him likewise in revealing it. So
Sohemus, who's sort of a second person under Herod, has passed on this news that Herod, having been sent to Rome because he was mates with Antony, who Caesar isn't a fan of,
is now dead.
Possibly. So everyone thinks that Herod is dead, which is where we're getting towards the play.
Oh.
It's like the play is rattling its way ahead of us.
We'll get there eventually.
So Seamus seems much more important than the play ever makes him out as. He just comes across as a rather unimportant courtier in the play.
Is this ever mentioned then, that she was his charge?
No, not really. Yeah. It doesn't come across. It might be in the text, but isn't really clear.
Okay.
But it really doesn't come across that way. Until I'd read that, I was just going, oh, is he that important? I didn't think he was that important.
He's just some guy.
I didn't see he was just some guy. He was just another butler or nuncio somewhere around the house. I think that's unfair. I think I knew he did something.
Okay. So at Herod's return, which was speedy and unexpected, he found Mariam so far from joy that she showed apparent signs of sorrow. He, still desiring to win her to a better humour, she, being very unable to conceal her passion, fell to upbraiding him with her brother's death. As they were thus debating, came in a fellow with a cup of wine, who, hired by Salome, said first it was a love potion, which Mariam desired to deliver to the king, but afterwards he affirmed that it was a poison, and that Sohemus had told her somewhat which procured the vehement hate in her. Eh?
Love your pause there. So, Salome's sent in this cup of wine saying it's a love potion.
Yeah.
And then it's actually poison and blame it all on Sohemus.
Yeah.
And he turned Mariam against you.
Which procured the vehement hate in her. So that's what caused Mariam to hate.
Yes. Except none of that's true.
No.
It's all a lie.
I don't know what you're talking about. It's entirely true.
In the play, remember, this is action, which is almost happens without any explanation and is just so random. It's one of the major plot holes.
Yeah.
It's sort of mentioned in passing, but nobody properly explains it to the audience.
And this is going to help so much.
Yeah, well, I think once I add more interjections to this.
Okay. So the king, hearing this, more moved with jealousy of Sohemus than with this intent of poison, sent her away, and presently after, by the instigation of Salome, she was beheaded, which rashness was afterward punished in him with an intolerable and almost frantic passion for her death.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Who knew?
Yeah. As an argument, it does give you some backstory. It doesn't mention that you marry again before you then prepare to marry again.
And then become queen.
Become queen, which I will double check before I put this out. Mm. I'm fairly certain that's the droid we're looking at.
So when they say the argument,
it's
more of a synopsis.
Yeah,
yeah,
that's
so the lead up.
And it's a very literary thing. It's not like a chorus in a play where you go, aha!
This is the story.
This is the story.